This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. When Nicholas Katsanis got the chance to start a lab at Duke, he had one goal in mind. He wanted to narrow the gap between genetic research and clinical practice, and he wanted to do it fast. So he created the Center for Human Disease Modeling. Mapping the human genome was a big step forward in modern science, but knowing how to interpret the information and how to create clinical applications, that's another world. And those two worlds seemed very far apart. Nico Katsanis wanted to bring them closer together. Besides being the director of the Center for Human Disease Modeling, Nico is also a professor of cell biology and pediatrics at Duke University, and he joins me this hour on The State of Things. Nico, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
So tell me more about the goal of this lab.
It's a task. It's a very broad thing that we're trying to accomplish. So a number of years ago, I was working on a number of very rare conditions. And as the sequencing technology enabled us to decipher the genetic material of our patients to higher and higher resolution, it became pretty obvious that we were beginning to identify changes in the genetic code in our patients that we no longer had the ability and the tools to interpret. And that led to the question of, what on earth am I going to do? How much of this information am I able to responsibly give it back to the patients, many of whom have had a vested interest in our research for the best part of 10 or 20 years? And how am I going to make sense about the clinical reality of these individuals and try to help them navigate not only the understanding of what happened to them in the past and how they came to have some particular genetic disorder, but also what might the possibilities be for the future? And this was just a very small group of patients in a very small number of genetic disorders. Well, if you project this out to the entire patient population, and we have this adage that genetic disorders are individually rare but collectively common, and they might account for more than a quarter of hospital effort across the country. Actually, this is something that perhaps we don't fully understand. So when you couple the huge volume of patients across the globe with our ability to now sequence their genomes at reasonably high fidelity, it became pretty obvious to me that we had a massive disconnect and a massive gap.
Well, I want to get into this a little bit deeper in terms of what it is you're seeing, because we know, for instance, if you talk about a BRCA2 gene, there's something that's an indicator for breast cancer. There it is. I can see it. The interpretation seems to be, as I understand it, pretty obvious and a pretty easy diagnosis to make, or a pretty easy statement to make, interpretation, right?
Sometimes not. Well, therein lies the problem. And BRCA2 is a particularly acute example because you have potential surgical choices in front of you. It's a later onset disorder that you might actually be able to identify from a genetic perspective in young children. And then what do you do? I mean, it's a can of worms, and I don't have a good answer, except to say that the BRCAs actually exemplify the problem. There is a wordage in our vocabulary that is represents a vexing problem, and that wordage is variants of unknown significance. These are changes in people's genetic material. Some of them are in genes that we know are highly associated with disease, and for which we do not have high confidence that they are disease-causing. So if I might be permitted a slightly cynical comment, which is not really, I'm actually an internal optimist, and I'm truly thrilled to have the privilege of being part of genetics where it is today, because it is quite transformative. But the fundamental issue is that genetics is a little bit like archaeology. So we go to the site of a monumental battle and we examine the evidence and we dust off the relics and all that. And we can start making statements with great accuracy about what happened, why it happened, so-and-so general attack from the north with this much cavalry and so on and so forth. But the problem is that the vast majority of this information has very little predictive power about what's going to happen to the next side of battle. Or even worse, how we might be able to prevent the next side of battle, or if there's going to be a battle, at least to be prepared to cater for the wounded. And my hope and my aspiration, especially, and this is one of the main drivers why we built what we built at Duke, is to actually help inform that transition from posterior knowledge to prospective knowledge and predictive knowledge. And if I can just one more point to that is that a fundamental shift that it seems to me will have to happen is that we have to shift from absolutes to probabilistics. So classically, people want to achieve a definitive diagnosis. They want to call their monster something. And there's high innate value in that, both from a medical perspective, but also from an emotional perspective. If you know your demon, you're able to deal with it no matter how bad it gets. People don't deal very well with unknowns in general. But unfortunately, or it's not either neither fortunate nor unfortunate, actually, it's just the way it is, we have to move to a world in which we go from black and white boxes to continua. And we go from you have A, B, C to you have this probability for this and that probability for others. So it seems to me that some fraction of medicine might have to, and perhaps I'm being a little bit bold here, but I have the sense that some part of medicine is going to be risk management and risk assessment as opposed to cut and dry, black and white.
But what, in terms of what you do then at the lab and how that's different from, say, fighting the last war, understanding the last war, we can name it, we know what it is, but now what do we do with it? How does that change? Fundamentally, how does your lab work and what's different about that than say, the work that went into mapping the genome, naming these things?
Well, two things. The first thing is that I don't have a lab. I have a commune, and I believe very strongly in that, and hopefully later on in our conversation, we'll get a chance to get into that. But the fundamental idea is that we're interested at developing biological models for what we consider to be the morbid human genome. That is to say, the fraction of the human genome that is associated with clinical disease. And the way we want to develop the models is that so that we have better utility. So once you have a model that is cheap and fast and highly reproducible, then you can imagine that you can query this model 100 different ways. And in sometimes the goal is to be able to use this model in a very young, with information from a very young patient, to actually be able to make predictive calls about clinical challenges that this patient has not yet faced. And of course, the models are always going to be limited with regard to their ability to predict everything, but I have the hope and the sense that we might be able to give some useful information back to the physicians who will be able to perhaps tailor-make their approaches to the management of the patient, in some cases predict some types of catastrophe. So that's the overriding goal.
And this is where the zebrafish comes in, right?
This is where the zebrafish comes in. And it's a wonderful little animal. It tastes horrible, just in case people are wondering. But it is a wonderful developmental biology model because, first of all, it has many similarities to humans. Between 70 and 80% of all human genes will be found in some iteration of these genes, will be found in the zebrafish genome. The embryo is transparent, and it will develop most of the major organs that we also have in the matter of a few days. So, and the other point is that we can genetically manipulate this animal transiently in a matter of hours and days. That opens up opportunity to investigate the pathology of a human being real time, as opposed to having to wait for years and years and years to get the right answer. So you can imagine, for example, let's say that you have an infant who has some pathology, let's say some facial problems and maybe some neuroanatomical defect. You have detected some problem in the brain or the muscle or the heart or the kidneys. And you have seen this problem through clinical imaging or what have you. And let us imagine that in the world that we're about to live in, that child, in addition to getting their CBCs and blood tests and all that, will also get their genome done. This is not science fiction. This is coming soon to a hospital near you, and if the hospital near you doesn't do it, then Walmart will, because it's just one another technology is here. Right. People will do it, so it will be some version of Gattaca, the old movie that you might remember. So not as scary though, I hope. So then the question becomes: you know that this child will have some amount of variation in their genome that might be predicted to alter the function of some proteins. And then the question becomes, which variation and how much of this variation might actually be relevant to that human being? And how can I test that? So what we do is we say, okay, well, let's say that this child has a shortened jaw as part of their clinical presentation. What could that mean? Let's say we have sequenced their genome, and let's say we have found a few dozen genes that carry variants that we don't like based on databases we looked at, prediction problems we looked at, many different things.
But not necessarily shorter jaws or any of the other
clinical
presentations.
No, this is just normal. Here's a protein, and it carries a change, and I have not seen that change in 15,000 normal, whatever normal is, human beings.
Right.
Well, I don't like the look of that change.
Yep.
But is that change relevant to the jaw pathology that this child has? Well, the experiment there is you basically take that gene in the zebrafish, and you delete it in zebrafish. And you ask the question, does that effect lead to a jaw, to a shortened jaw in the animal? And then the next step is you reintroduce the human gene into the, you humanize the zebrafish essentially. And what you hope to see is that you have restored normal jaw. And then you say, now I'm going to look for this change that I found in that little baby. And oh, look, when I put that change in, I know I'm no longer able to reconstitute a normal jaw. Therefore, this change is likely to be relevant to the pathology of the jaw. Now, once you have that, you can start going in and asking questions about what does the protein do? What does it mean? Are there any known pharmacological targets for it? Can we say anything about the pathway? Can we say anything about this mutation being in other members of the family? There's 100 permutations.
On the frontiers of genetic research with Niko Katsanis today, director of the Center for Human Disease Modeling and professor of cell biology and pediatrics at Duke. We're meeting him today on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking with Niko Katsanis, director of the Center for Human Disease Modeling and a professor of cell biology and pediatrics at Duke University. So we're talking about sort of how to bridge this gap between the genetic research and then clinical applications. And one way is this kind of, you should pardon the expression, bait and switch, I guess, with the zebrafish. It's not really a bait and switch, but you're swapping out these suspect genes to see whether or not that's the offending culprit.
Yes. So there's a long way to go. I don't want to give the false impression that this is simple, done and dusted, and off we go now. It's there's many pieces that need to be filled in before we can reach to clinical utility, but our trajectory is very much for that. A fundamental question is that there is in science, we talk a lot about sensitivity. How sensitive is your assay at picking up a perturbation, a change?
How sensitive is your test?
Yeah. But there's also something else that is specificity, which is how often do you get it wrong? And if we were ever in my idealized world to be able to move some of these biochemical assays and fish and mice and worms and all the things that we're doing into the clinical realm, we need to be highly mindful of our false positive and our false negative rate, because this will highly influence the ability of our physician colleagues to take that information and relay that information to patients in a manner that is understandable and actionable. Because if we start making things a little bit too loose, and if we're a little bit too sci-fi about this, then two things might happen. Once, we might execute disservice to the patient population that is looking to us, and I think that's important that we avoid. And the other thing is that we might end up overhyping things, which is also something that we should avoid with fervor and zest.
But of course, you're going to be in the position of maybe putting out the science and being as careful as you want. But if I, for instance, am not you, I am a drug company that talks about what to do if you have a high probability of this sort of thing and I want to promote that drug, it's out of your hands now, right?
To a degree, I think that scientists have – I think that it would be – that's a easy way of getting out of it, say, I didn't do it. I think that scientists could be doing a better job at vocalizing and verbalizing their discoveries and their work in a accurate and responsible fashion. I fervently reject the argument that the general population is unable to understand what we do in research laboratories. I think that is a profound disservice to the ability of people who are not trained in the sciences to understand what we do, and it potentially reeks of elitism. So I reject that. I think, though, at the same time, we really need to do a better job at, first of all, not over-promising so that we can secure the resources that we need, because this is the ball and chain thing, but also we are able to explain things in lay terms. We are able to explain the strengths and weaknesses of every experiment that we do in ways that we can engage the you know, general population in a good conversation.
You talked go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that this is going to be, I think, useful, necessary, and you know what? It's also fun.
Well, let's talk about the fun part and the useful and necessary part, all of which are wrapped up in perhaps what you said earlier, the fact that you've designed a commune, not a lab.
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, so just for comic relief, let's imagine for a moment the traditional academic paradigm. So the traditional
That's
academic...
That's not funny.
Well, depends on your point of view, because I think it's... Well, it depends. So if we in a very... And this is going to be a sort of very oversimplified view, but just for the sake of conversation, let us say that a academic professor begets three academic professors during their career. This is not an unreasonable supposition. And in fact, I'm in the very pleasurable situation of I've already done that. There's a few people out there who had the... privilege or not, to be trained by me, and who have their own academic labs right now. That means that we can sit down with pen and paper and calculate, but that means if you take this to the fullness of the argument, that if we essentially have a 3-to-1 expansion, which is a hyper-logarithmic expansion, that, by the year 2200 or something like that, the entire planet will be composed exclusively of academic professors. Who thinks that this is attainable? I mean, bacteria do this, and they go into colony destruction and, and catastrophe. You know, they can't make it. The fundamental that is one piece of, and I am being a little bit sort of glib about this, but this is one piece. The other piece, of course, that science is becoming increasingly more complex, and we find ourselves in dire need of interdisciplinary research, of very strong and careful interaction with colleagues who have different sensitivities, different biases, different training backgrounds, and different knowledge of the toolset. And let's not forget that the volume of the scientific literature is absolutely enormous. It is impossible to devour it in an entire lifetime. Somebody said to me a number of years ago that they said to me, did you know that the number of scientists working today are potentially more than all the scientists that ever existed in the history of mankind added together? I don't know that this is true. Mm. It wouldn't surprise me if it were. But that means that we have this huge volume, this huge cloud that has generated a lot of noise. So what my vision, I don't particularly like using that word because it's assumed that you have some sort of grand visionary ability, which I don't think I do. But my thought is that if you put together a cluster of individuals who have different sensitivities and different experience and see the worldview in different ways, you will find wonderful and magical things happening at the interface of our mutual ignorance, because this is the space that no individual will have seen all around, and we can accelerate discovery. So that's one piece of it. The second piece of it is that I personally loathe the traditional pyramidal scheme where you have the almighty powerful professor at the front, at the top, being a self-assumed benevolent dictator who mandates and exudes wisdom to Epopoli. I think that can work in many cases, but I think I have personally found more gratification by having a more horizontal system when people can have a good conversation and have the freedom to tell each other how their ideas suck and how about this and have this other thing. So I am a big champion of this model. The other thing is I feel that, and this is something that academic medicine and science and funding organizations and everybody will have to deal with, that I feel that the traditional paradigm of the vertical structures is not really as efficient. So if corporations were running their R&D the way that academic science is running its R&D, they might not have gone very far. I can't imagine, I don't know how they do it, but I can't imagine Apple having, you know, its academic professor equivalents and all them working in some sort of Brownian way and hoping that they will invent the iPhone. I would imagine that it would be a team of people with expertise that came together to accomplish a task.
But as a practical matter, how does that work? How do you recruit who you're looking for? They have to have some expertise, certainly in genetics, biology, medicine.
Yes, of course. There's many ways to recruit. Some people say that it doesn't really matter because your success and failure rate is as one individual, it is very difficult to make accurate judgment calls about capability and personality. Although if you start crowdsourcing this, so typically we do not recruit people in the unit that before having a discussion within the unit about what we thought. And my experience has been that our batting average, as it were, in terms of bringing in new people who match, has improved significantly once we started exercising our communal wisdom. Because it goes to my fundamental core where the total is greater than the sum of the parts. And this is, if there was ever a mantra for me, this would be it.
So recruitment actually begins at that consensual level. You bring everybody in on that discussion, and now we're going to have a group that's...
That's right. And everybody, because also recruits have the different sensitivities as well, and they run slightly different conversations. I mean, each one of us can see a different facet of a candidate. But the most important thing for me is that the people who come and join our commune, they're not the sort of people... We know what we don't like. What we don't like is people who are after number one. That does not work very well. And there's a difference between ambition. I cherish ambition. I think it's a major force in human nature, and it should be applauded. But at the same time, it should be ambition through community. And for me, it's the behavioral traits and the personalities that are more important than the technical abilities. You can always gain some technical ability. You can always, if you're interested enough, you can gain more knowledge. But what you cannot really gain is your fundamental building blocks of your personality. So if you're not a synthetic person with others, you're never going to be a synthetic person with others. This is not derogatory towards people who have one particular personality versus another. It's just that some personalities work for our unit and some do not. And I must say, my observation has been that as a group, we are pretty good at sussing out who might be a good fit and who might not be a good fit. We are built to succeed. We will tolerate failure and we will learn from it. So it's not, I don't want to transmit the false impression that I have the answer to how to run a perfect unit. Far from it. We have many, many failings and disaster stories to talk about. But the fundamental fact remains that I have personally observed that our creativity and our productivity has increased many orders of magnitude since we implemented this model. And this is about 3 years now.
How did you get involved in science? When did you get interested?
Well, I got off the wrong bus.
So your career in science begins with an error. Good.
My career in science begins with a comedy of errors. But given this show, I think we will focus on the greatest error of all. Well, so it's a number of things. So I should say that for some of the things, I didn't realize how it happened and what happened until I grew up a little bit. My wife will tell me that was after I turned 35. And when I was able to look back on my life, and I think it is true that most of our lives and choices and careers are defined by a small number of nodes. And you can't help but wonder whether if you had taken the different choice at each of these nodes, what sort of person you have been today. And that's a scary thought for a self-deterministic scientist. Nonetheless, so there were a couple of events. I was a young child. I was in my early teens when I understood what was happening to some cousins of mine, and I had a cousin with a catastrophic genetic disorder. And even though I was about 12 years old, I have these crystal clear and vivid memories of her spasticity, her anger tantrums. It was awful. And I realized later that even as a 12-year-old, I could feel the anxiety in my aunt and uncle. And it wasn't just the patient, it was the entire nuclear explosion in this entire family. And I learned later that they had a baby. When she turned 4, she started deteriorating. Then eventually she died when she was 17 years old. And this is an awful story. And I found myself becoming progressively angrier about this because I felt that this just should not happen to human beings. I know it sounds a little simplistic, and I certainly don't want to give this bleeding hearts type of story, but this is what happened to me, and I thought, by golly, somebody's got to do something about it in my own naive little way. Then
we should say you grew up in Greece.
I grew up in Greece, and I finished high school in Greece. And then I knew I wanted to do genetics. The other thing that happened to me is that I fell in love with these Punnett squares that people might remember, you know, the wrinkled peas and the straight peas. And you do these sort of 2x2 tables. And it felt like a little sort of puzzle game to me. And I thought, of course, genetics was Punnett squares and Mendel and wrinkled peas. What are you going to do? And I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
I think what I thought deep down was that this was a... I've now connected the dots. And I can't be sure that this is the accurate connection of the dots. But I think... what I was looking in wrinkled peas and genes was visually connecting to me with what had happened. I was beginning to gain a little bit of understanding and clarity. So I thought, this is it. I've got to do genetics. There was no question in my mind. I was one of those very, I think, blessed people who have had epiphany happen to them at a very young age. And I didn't fully recognize it as then. I was 16, 17, 18, so... and male, so my level of maturity was non-existent. But deep down, the seeds were there. It wasn't just a seed, it was a center block. So there was no genetics in Greece, and my parents urged me to go overseas, and that was a really scary time. And as a 17-year-old, I moved to England, and I did... A-levels, which is sort of preparatory SAT equivalents to get into university. And what happened was, to cut a long story short, initially the only path that was clear to me was to go to medical school and then from there do genetics. Because in those days, there were only about maybe three institutions in the United Kingdom that were offering degrees in genetics. It gives me, of course, great satisfaction to now know that not only this has changed, but also now many of the degrees have split into human genetics and general genetics, which I think is testament to the progress of the field. So the particular day that changed my life is there's some lessons that I learned from this experience, I have to say. So I had just come back from an interview with the admissions officer at St. George's Hospital, who said to me that they would be very happy to take me on as a medical student, but their quota was full for that year, but they would like me to study the year after. And I'm in this bus, and I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do for a year? I wasn't used to not doing something academic. I had done the odd jobs and this and that, but I was always sort of a student. So the idea of not being a student for a year was kind of scary. And I'm on this bus, and I'm supposed to go to Euston Station, which is one of the main King's Cross, Euston. These are some of the main train stations in London. And, of course, I'm on the bus, and I didn't know London very well. And I heard, you know, from the exceptional loudspeaker, Euston. And I thought, oh, this must be me. I'll get off. And I get off, and I'm in the middle of the street. And, of course, it wasn't Euston. It was Euston Square, which is a little different. They're close to each other, about a quarter of a mile apart. But I had a little baggie in my shoulder, and I thought, "Oh, I'll just go this way." So I was on a crossroads, as it were, and I had five choices. So I went down this one street, and as I'm walking one block, I look at the left, and I see the dome of the main building of University College London, UCL, and I thought to myself, "Oh, I remember this place. I saw it in some piece of literature I was looking at before, and they have a program in genetics. I will go in and ask." So as you do, I basically waltzed into the main reception, and there was this young guy, I can still make his caricature in my mind, even though it's been years. And I said to him, "Hi, I'm here because I'd like to do genetics, please," or something lame to that effect, yeah, you know? Yeah. So, you know, you're supposed to, like, fill out forms, month ahead of times, and get letters of reference.
They don't
and all
really
those
do
good
walk-ins.
They don't do walk-ins. It's not a hairdresser's.
Yeah.
Right. And he just looked at me, and, you know, I had, you know, tongue firmly stuck on cheek, right? And he said to me, "Let me see what I can do for you." So he called over to the genetics department, and a Dr. Leach picked up the phone. I don't know exactly what they said. He must have said something like, "You what? And now you're crazy?" But nonetheless, he hung up the phone and he gave him a little smile. He says, well, Dr. Leach will be able to see you on Thursday. This was Tuesday. And I was like, great, I'll be here Thursday, 2 o'clock, whatever it was. So on Thursday, I met with Dr. Leach, who was an elderly gentleman, but he was very kind to me. So he looked at me. We had an interview for half an hour. He looked at my grades. I had decent grades. And he said to me, you know what? I think we've got one spot left. And yeah, sure, you can have it. Why not?
And that was it.
And that was it.
That was it.
I started doing genetics.
Wow.
This was early September, and college started 3.5 weeks later. So I canceled my plans to go back to Greece and try to figure something to do something out for a year. And I started doing genetics.
Wow.
Said, I know, right?
I got a lab coat here. I think it fits. You have to bring your own pocket protector, but otherwise you're in.
Pretty much.
Wow.
Pretty much. And then, of course, the epiphany was that, you know, genetics, what I thought was genetics and what really was genetics, was very, very different.
Well, we're going to find out about that and what you learned when you were at the University of London and how you came to Duke. And when our conversation with Niko Katsanis continues, he founded his own lab at Duke called the Center for Human Disease Modeling. He's also a professor of cell biology and pediatrics. And our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking to Niko Katsanis. He is director of the Center for Human Disease and Modeling, Disease Modeling at Duke. So you talk about you kind of walking up to the university saying, I'm interested in genetics, and them having one seat left, and then you go. So, but you said just before we took the break that you had one idea of genetics, what it was, and then you learned differently. I mean, talk about that. What were you thinking you would do? What did you think genetics was when you walked in that door?
Punnett squares, wrinkle peas. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Really simple things. And then people started talking to me about restriction enzymes that are able to tailor cut DNA. And then people started talking about sequence. And I should say that I was very, very fortunate because at each stage of my education, and my education continues, I think it's a fallacy to say the education stops when you get whatever degree, I was always able to find myself surrounded by people at the extreme cutting edge of this. And if you follow the spiral of human genetics from the early 90s, when I was a newbie undergrad who thought the world was made of wrinkled peas, to today, where we're talking about sequencing patient genomes ad hoc and interpreting, that's only 2 decades. And if you project this forward 2 decades from now, and I certainly hope that they will still be doing academic science in 2 decades, it's breathtaking. I don't even know where it is. So if you track over trajectory, you find out how much more you learn and how you're... I think the secret is that you have to allow yourself to expand your mind as this new torrent of new information comes and hits you and redefines your models, redefines your perceptions, and you become broader and more interested in broader questions.
But, you know, it seems like a really difficult challenge in term, not just because there's a lot of information coming in, a torrent of information as you described it. It's the what. There's a lot of new what's every day, but then the context is constantly shifting. What to do with it becomes the next problem. We talked about this earlier. And it seems to me that the ground beneath you is shifting when you try to, when you talk about interpreting. So,
absolutely.
So it's learning, it's knowing what it is, and then interpretations change even as the information washes over you.
That's exactly right. But to be quite frank with you, I would not have it any other way, because if your ground is too stable, you don't challenge yourself enough. You always need to be able to jump, to move. And always my other mantra, I suppose, has been jump without looking, time and time again. And one of my old mentors has said to me many years ago that you should think about reinventing yourself every 5 to 7 years. And I think in my field, that is a necessary thing to do, because you don't have another way to renew. You don't have another way to resensitize yourselves to the questions that have now become pertinent because knowledge has increased, because technology has increased. So the moment you stagnate, you find yourself becoming passé in months, not years. So
You talk about the mentors that you had. There was one in London who suggested that you go to the U.S.
There was. So this was Lizzie Fisher, to whom I feel I owe essentially everything, for two reasons. The first one is that I was an atrocious graduate student. And when I say atrocious, I need to capitalize and underline that statement. I would not have me as a graduate student now.
And, well, what was atrocious about you?
It's long complicated. I was... irresponsible. I was unprofessional. I did not have my head straight. I was all over the map. I think the few years being away from home, away from Paris and all that had finally sat in and hit. And I was having the, I think, classical struggles of the early immigrants who now start feeling completely disconnected from parent country, but also is disconnected from present country because he or she does not fit yet. So it was all this complex. And in all this, I was in my early 20s. And this is a very tough time to be when you're sort of trying to explore and define yourself. But for better or for worse, she stuck by me and she saw something. And I was able to eventually, I have to say, I met my wife towards my late graduate school, and she kind of grounded me, organized me, and helped me graft a path forward. And Lizzie said to me, you know, you need to go to the United States because the way they do science there is different. You need to have the U.S. experience. You don't have to live there for a very long time if you don't want to, but you should at least go into postdoctoral training for a few years.
What's different about it? Forgive me for interrupting this.
No, there's a number of things that are different. First of all, the critical mass here is greater, so there's more people in not everywhere, but in some places, and actually North Carolina is one of them. There is a very high concentration of science, which means that you have the opportunity to interact with a very diverse set of people and learn very, very quickly. The other thing is that there's this something that I have felt in this country as an immigrant, I suppose, is that there's always this youthful exuberance. It's almost, it's the adoring side of teenagers. Maybe Europeans are the sort of old, jaded 65-year-olds who look at everything slightly scornfully but carry great wisdom. Whereas here, I found this can-do attitude, even though some of the things that you do because you can are not exactly the things that you should do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little short on wisdom, but go ahead.
A little short on wisdom, but very high on exuberance and very high on confidence that things are, anything is possible. And that was wonderful. The other thing that I found here was this exceptional meritocracy. There is no perfect system. However, compared to anything else that I'd seen, I was convinced that if you have a good idea here, it will find fertile ground and grow. And I can offer many, many examples of that. And these are some of the things that I cherished and valued very deeply. And you know what? I came for a short postdoc in 1997, and here I am still, and I have no plans to leave. So
where was your first work? When did you...
So I went to... I was halfway through. This is the thing. I was sort of halfway through my PhD, maybe a little bit over, and I already knew that I wanted to be an academic scientist. It was one of these things. I never had to wonder. When I was at high school, I knew I wanted to go to University of Genetics. When I was at undergrad, I knew I wanted to do a PhD. When I wanted to do a PhD, I knew I wanted to become an academic professor. In fact... you know, my wife and I still talk about when I was telling her when I was 24 or 25 that I'll be an endowed professor before I'm 40. And she would roll her eyes at me. I was like, no, you don't understand.
You'd probably made a few other promises that you didn't keep. So maybe that's why she
never. I kept every single one
Bless
of them.
You.
Except
right.
for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So I interviewed with a few people, and it was, again, I was really spoiled for choice because I was very fortunate to get invitations from several individuals in different parts of the country. But for some reason or other, we ended up at Baylor in Texas, in Houston.
Back to Houston.
Back to Houston.
Yeah, right.
And it was awesome. It was, I connected viscerally with Jim Lupski, who became my postdoctoral mentor. I had many wonderful interviews. I got along very well with many of the people that I met. But with this one person, I felt a immediate connection. It's, you know, it's the sort of thing that happens to people from time to time. And he was a stupendous mentor to me, and I learned so much from him. And then from there, I did some work. This is when I started my work on Bardet Biedl syndrome, which is this rare genetic disorder that we knew nothing about. I remember Jim telling me that he thought I had lost my marbles for wanting to do this because it was hard and it was a big black box and we didn't even know where to start. There was no edge that we can grab.
And what is Bardet Biedl?
It's a rare genetic disease. The children with BBS go blind progressively through life. They have problems with obesity and diabetes. They have a complicated presentation of neurodevelopmental and neuropsychiatric defects. They have extra digits. There's a number of things that are challenges for them. And the biggest challenge of all for me was, what are the genes causing this thing, and why are patients with BBS so different from each other? So we all used to putting patients together, but we wanted to get them also separate.
And this, this is complicated because it's not one gene. Now we're talking about multiple genes being involved. We can't even guess which ones because it presents in so many different
ways. That's right. And the fundamental and the other issue is that if you find the primary causal mutations for some gene, then for the same mutations, you have patients presenting with very different clinical presentation. Right. And that was really interesting and challenging because to me as a geneticist, when you have the same primary mutation, you expect to see the same thing over and over in the clinic. At least that was what my naive mind used to think. But of course, that reality or pseudo-reality was extinguished very, very quickly. And what replaced it was the understanding that mutations in a primary causal gene, they don't operate in a vacuum. They operate in the context of your entire genome and your environment and everything else. Now, of course, these are not new concepts, but they were new to me. And they guided me along my trajectory, moving from we identified the first gene for BBS. Then soon after that, I moved to Johns Hopkins to start my own lab. And I was there for seven wonderful, wonderful years. And during that time, we learned more about cell biology and more molecular biology about BBS. We're now beginning to talk about therapeutics, and I don't know if it'll work out, but just thinking about me walking around at 11 o'clock at night at the campus of Baylor thinking, will I ever get the gene for this in 1998 and 14 years later talking about maybe therapeutics is a spectacular journey that I cherish like my most intimate treasure.
And now that work is being done elsewhere. You're still working on it?
I'm still working part of it, but now this particular rare disorder, I used to go to these conferences and go, what? And people couldn't pronounce it. Of course, now most people know the syndrome, and we've had the opportunity to engage other people. We now have a little bit of competition on this. I think that's a good thing. It keeps you on your toes. It makes you think harder. And from that point of view, it's been great. But then in 08, Bridget Hogan, the chair of the Department of Cell Biology, in her usual delightful cheeky self, she called me up. And she was at Duke. I was at Hopkins. So I pick up the phone. And it's like, hi, this is Bridget Hogan. And I would like to see if you're interested in coming down to Duke. And I was like, no, thanks. I'm okay. You know, I was at Hopkins. Things were going well. My young family was doing very well. But then I came down. I said, look, tell you what. I will come down for just an informal meet and greet. I've never had the chance to visit people at Duke. It's obviously a good school. Why not? And I said, but let's do this incognito, okay? Right. So I came down. And the first thing I see is my mugshot plastered at various places around campus with the words faculty candidate above it.
Okay.
So I'm like, okay, great. If that's the incognito version,
you're not going back.
I would love to see what the non-incognito version is.
Right.
But this was actually quite helpful because I was really not interested in just transplanting my lab from A to B. Just maybe get some more resources and whatever. But Bridget and a few others asked me, well, what is it that you really want to do? And this was the trigger of drawing from a decade of lessons and frustrations in my sort of work with Bardet-Biedl syndrome and the various thoughts, amorphous, nebulous thoughts that I had about how the work on this particular one rare disease was highlighting issues across the entire gamut of human genetic disorders. That I thought, maybe this is it. Maybe if I come up with this notion of trying to attack genetic disease in a systematized fashion, maybe Duke will be stupid enough to go for it. And you know what? They did.
They did.
They did. And kudos to them because I was still idea forming, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I've got it all figured out because I have not. But we were able to sort of come up with this, and the last 2.5 years that my research lab has been at Duke have been some of the most rewarding in my professional career, bar none.
What have you learned? What have you learned about what needs to be done and about how this needs to be done? I mean, talk about sort of maybe...
I've learned that we need to broaden our hypotheses. I've learned that the more preconditions that you put in on your interpretation of your experiments, the more likely you are to be obscure from the truth. So
the more preconditions you put on the terms of your experiments, is that what you
and
said?
Yes, on the right. on the more filters you put yeah. on the interpretation of experiments,
okay.
the more likely you're going to be obscured from the truth.
Yeah.
Because you're introducing biases.
Right.
And we shouldn't do that. And in many cases, we used to introduce biases because, well, there was no technology to do things in a broader, unbiased fashion. Now we have the ability to ask some more unbiased questions. And some of the lessons that we're learning are interesting and scary. So here's a realization. We have been studying, the community has been studying rare patients with rare genetic disorders for a very, very long time. And these might represent, 1, 2, 3% of the population, some very small fraction. I don't know what that fraction is. But we have somewhere along the line assumed that the genetic lessons that we learn from this fringe population, if you like, and I don't mean fringe in a societal way, I mean fringe in terms of numbers, somehow these lessons actually apply to the remaining of the population. Well, this may or may not be true. Frankly, we don't have data to support or reject this. But people have made the automatic assumption. And that is really dangerous because that can lead us to false interpretations, or perhaps not false, but half-truths. Sometimes half-truths are the worst kind because you can look at it and you can identify a portion of the truth that is convincing, but you're just missing the other side.
You've said that you worry about a kind of a paternalism that's building in the field of genetics.
I am. I worry about the notion that somehow, daddy knows best. You don't know what kind of information you need. I know what kind of information you need. Says who? If anything else, let's see if the population themselves are able to decide. So we're already assuming that the population is too stupid to understand the kind of information that they need. I find that statement rather offensive.
Isn't it because we just don't know enough about that? Nobody has a good handle on how to interpret this so that
But of course.
Yeah.
I think that is true. So look, some of this is reasonably founded by reasonable people. I don't want to be polemical to that view because there are merits. The first thing is that there is a huge amount of uncertainty to this, and we've got to be careful. Two is that it is true that people can interpret information the way that it suits them or not. So we've got to be careful. And the third thing, of course, is that we do not have the tool set to respond to people coming to us with torrent of questions and uncertainties with regard to their genomic information. So that's one side. On the other side, it's their information, it's their genome, they should know it. So there's a conversation going on, but I think that we need to figure out a happy medium. I think the current views going on are extreme.
Nico, I wish we had more time for this conversation, but a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Nico Katsanis is director of the Center for Human Disease Modeling at Duke University. He's also a professor of cell biology and pediatrics. And that is our program for today. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. You can find us at stateofthings.org, a program produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Robin Copley, the technical director. Our intern is Sarah Edwards, managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.